So I'm going to get this going. The rules of engagement are I'm going to talk to the panel with an opening question to each of them, but the emphasis is upon yourselves. We've got a couple of roving mics with individuals holding green banners. I think it says questions. So just catch my eye. If you've got a question, that'd be, I'd be delightful. Try not to turn it into a statement, but much more interested in, you know, just say kind of what's on your mind, what the question is, to whom are you directing it, or are you not? And just try to be sort of as focused, because time will elapse, it seems to me. So it's important to make sure that we get as many people participating as possible. So I'm going to get this going. So I'm going to turn to Nicole, first of all. And I was struck in particular by her description of those who are very far away from the labour market. People who are actually either underemployed or have been out of work for a very long period of time. And I want to get her to talk to us a little bit about the obstacles that have to be overcome in order to make sure that people are, workers are work ready. It's very easy to say there's a job, there's a worker, hook them together with one another. But oftentimes when people are out of work, you find there's a lack of awareness of what's going on in the workplace, some impact on their confidence, indeed identity, and a whole host of issues, which mean that you need to, in a sense, prepare people in what may be called in the jargon the intermediate labour market. Could you talk a little bit about how that might be an obstacle that needs to be overcome before people are actually turning up for work in these new jobs?
Yeah, absolutely. So probably as the other speaker said, everything's moving very, very fast. And there's some big cohorts in our community that are not even aware this is going on and how they fit in. In terms of the support required, it's many and varied. So, it could range from significant non-vocational issues to do with stable housing, numeracy, literacy, drug and alcohol issues, criminal histories, all those types of things, through to vocational gaps, lack of education, just not having those skills, licences, short courses, qualifications, and then through to employability skills, how to apply for a job, how to look for a job. We still have many older unemployed people saying, where's the jobs gone in the paper? They're not digitally literate, not able to even search for employment online. And even in our industry, we are being automated ourselves. So the federal government is digitalising a lot of what we do in the employment services industry, which will mean job seekers won't even get a consultant to support them. They'll have to log on online and the computer says do X and they'll have to go off and do it. And for a lot of our job seekers, they can't read and write English, let alone have access to the internet and have those digital literacy skills to even do the basics. It's already here and they're already struggling. So it's going to get even worse as we go along. So probably you've got to think outside the box for a lot of our customers that come through our doors and how they might fit the labour market. And again, they might fit that job for 5 years and then it's gone and then what do they do next? So it is that constant learning and getting people to constantly skill up, and they're going to need support along the way. And it might even be us acknowledging that some people may not gain paid work in their lifetime. So what else could they do? Is there other frameworks or social frameworks we can offer people in that environment? Because it's going to get harder and harder for a lot of our, some of our community who just don't quite fit the mould. But a lot of intense support, a lot of work experience where you can't lose your job. So you're just getting that experience and the pressure's off. We find is very, very valuable for getting those employability skills right, just how to function at the workplace, get off the phone while you're at work, all those things that we take for granted, help improve skills, especially for young people. Sometimes young people, 4 or 5 goes before it sticks, the job sticks. Yeah.
Thank you. Can I turn to Anne? We had a chance to talk over lunch, so this is kind of slightly rehearsed. But the main point was it's in a good place. I mean, you've got 88% of employers saying they're happy with what's going on, and 80% of employees. So those are remarkably high levels of satisfaction. So that's the kind of good news. But the sort of hidden bit of this, and you did allude to this in your own presentation, was to do with status. I mean, systems of education and training can even accidentally, without intentionally do this, end up creating a very sharp distinction between some groups of workers, and particularly where they've been educated, and other groups of workers, and so on and so forth. So in regards to vocational education and the training that comes from that, and these great prospects that you've identified, are there particular ways we can overcome issues of status?
Interesting question, and I think a challenge for us. What we do know, and I think it's a theme through some of the presentations today, is that while STEM skills are certainly going to be fundamental going forward, what the real emphasis is on the enterprise skills, you know, the interpersonal skills, the analysis, the problem solving. And when you think about the occupations that are growing, and I am going to once again acknowledge Deloitte here, there is a recognition that it is about the hard skills going forward. There's always that soft judgment that's needed and that delicate interpersonal relationship. And indeed, care workers, for example, will probably become a very scarce and much valued resource if someone's very, very good in that space. And we are already seeing that actually in the industry. There are different rates of pay dependent on how good you are in how you relate to others. Of course, what we'll also see is potentially more men coming into that occupation as some of the more routine tasks cease to offer employment prospect. And perhaps too, the sort of pay equity issues may also modify slightly as one, the sector becomes seen as valued, but also there's a mix of sexes, which traditionally has impacted on return. So I think that's a good maybe example of what can change. May I say, in the trades area, the remuneration is actually enormous. I'm sure your electricians and my a plumber earns more than most of us in this room. So, you know, but perhaps more particularly, the very skilled machinists, fitters, welders, etc., who are actually dealing with a combination of technical activities coming together, also heavy auto, electrical, etc. So we're seeing cross-skilling and, you know, really fine skills in some of our highly technical area with enormous return and reward for those in those spaces.
Thank you, cheers. Simon, I heard you say that the knowledge workers have got a difficult future, yeah, for the reasons you went into right at the start. So the first thing that went through my mind, it may have gone through much of the UWA table's minds as well, which was, what about the knowledge industry? What about people in institutions that are heavily embedded in those industries? They produce the knowledge workers. I mean, how are, not so much the TAFEs, but how are the universities going to respond to this? Might people start to bypass universities, for instance?
Well, I think there's several questions embedded in there, and I think, you know, the last one is a very significant one. We will start to see people bypassing university. The issue, of course, at the moment, and universities understand this, and I speak to many vice-chancellors and presidents around the world, that as soon as the incoming student gets a perception that there is an alternative and that industry will respect that alternative and recognise that alternative and hire them, then of course they lose the incentive to go to university, because university has always been pitched to them as, you know, if you want a good job, if you want to guarantee a job, you've got to go to university. If you don't go to university, you know, your life is worthless. Okay, you could be a plumber, electrician, but the chances of being the one who's earning more than everybody in this room is pretty rare. Most of them are pretty, you know, low paid. So if you really want to get on in life, you've got to go to university. And of course, this started in the early 90s, and the perception was, well, I don't know what I want to do at university, because I wasn't really that interested in stuff at school. So, of course, there's a plethora, and I'm going to be a little bit cynical here, I'm going to be a bit provocative, but there's a plethora of all of these generalist-type degrees. Now, some of them are discipline-based. You said, do psychology. You can always get a job if you're a psychologist. So psychology grew enormously in the 90s and early noughties. Or commerce and law, business studies. I mean, the UK in the early 90s went from a situation where out of 155 institutions, only about two or three of them taught business. but by the end of the 90s, every single one of them had a business department and business studies degrees. Accounting degrees and accounting departments in some universities in Australia are the biggest departments in the university. That are cash cows for the university in some instances. In the UK, there's one institution I know that has 93% of the revenue for the accounting department goes back to the centre to subsidise everything else that doesn't attract students. So universities have played this marketisation game, and even Professor Glyn Davis, when he was VC at Melbourne, said the same thing. We've made the rod for our own back. We've played a marketisation game saying, come to university because we're going to prepare you for the world of work. And yet then the student is now finding it's no guarantee of that job. So that's a real challenge for the universities, and it's a real challenge for the way in which they alter, you know, their offerings. And the problem fundamentally is the same problem that every other sector has faced, and it's why every other sector is being disrupted, but the health sector and the higher education sector are probably the last because there's no current viable alternatives. And the problem is there is so much invested in the infrastructure, buildings, campuses, people, it's very difficult to change your business model. And the business model of higher education is attract them, retain them so they don't leave, and then get them through the whole 4 years because that's my revenue stream. And that's very difficult to change that structure. So I hear a lot of vice chancellors talking about wanting to move into the micro-credentialing space, want to move into a space where students can come in, take a little bit, go somewhere else, take a bit more. Try as you buy before you buy. Do other things where they can stack qualifications, even get credit for experience elsewhere, bring it in and stack that towards another postgraduate qualification. They want to do this. Universities realize they need to do this. It's very hard to do it given the internal structures of the organization. So that becomes the challenge for the sector. It's a generic challenge, and every university understands it and faces it. But I think it illustrates a more complex challenge for the whole of culture and society. Now, the whole way in which, we were having this conversation over lunch, the whole way in which the fabric of society has been structured is still a 19th century industrial model. And so when we start to see technology and artificial intelligence nibble away at that model, it starts to fracture the very things that make sense of our life around us. We all have, you know, 9-to-5 type jobs. You drop your child off at free childminding for the day so you can go and work. Our cities are organized around schools and communities where commuting becomes easy, et cetera, et cetera. When artificial intelligence begins to change all that, what happens to all of these structures? It's not just a higher education problem, it's a whole of education problem. It's a whole of society problem because we're going to face very serious threats and, you know, implications to the way in which work and wealth creation is changing that's going to impact everything about the way society is structured, from primary school and school systems, especially with lifelong learning, right through to the way we work, right through to the way we live, the way we construct cities, the way we transport people around. So I think, you know, it is a big challenge, and the higher education sector probably faces the biggest challenge at the moment, because if the demand for the university degree diminishes rapidly, such that about 20 to 40% of students who currently go to university say, you know what, I don't need to go to university, I can acquire micro-credentials from other places that are good enough to get me a job, then you've got a few universities in serious trouble very quickly.
Okay, so turning to Nate, the what do we call them, the design-led firms, organisations, yeah? The ones who do it best. Remember, they were the ones who were particularly good at experimentation and learning. Sound like great places to work, as far as I can see. My question to you was, what do we do if there's a shortage of those organizations? If we train all the employees, would-be employees, to be highly skilled and to fit in, have we got enough of those workplaces to go around?
Yeah, I think looking at some of the organizations we're starting to work with here locally, you can start to see that this is a very long journey that we're all on. And I think it will be a very long time before we run out of these organizations, hopefully. Many of you probably in your organizations have an innovation program or a transformation program. Many of you are probably going through an agile transformation, which seems to be the hot buzzword at the moment. But I think, you know, these sort of design-led innovation, creative experimentation, they're becoming the natural way of working. The self-directed teams and using the ideas of agile, I think that is really becoming not just specific organisations, but just the way that organisations will need to work in order to be adaptable, in order to recruit talent, in order to retain those talent. And I think, you know, the next wave will be an adaption of that again. Not sure what that will look like, but I don't think we're going to run out anytime soon.
Okay, thank you. Right, can we just throw this open now, because this is the point of the exercise. There's some mics roving around. Just put your hand up, just catch my eye, and then we'll open it up.
Yeah, sorry.
There's one. What am I missing? Thank you, just there.
Thank you very much. It's been a very interesting talk. There was mention of the health sector being one of the big growth industries in those, and then also the decline in terms of accounting. So from the higher education sector, a lot of students choose to enrol in accounting, choose not to roll into the health sector because of pay gaps and those type of things. They're not interested in those jobs in the health sector. Mm. How do we encourage them to stop enrolling in accounting and start enrolling in the health sector?
To anyone in particular, or just I'm going
to... Just to anyone in...
Look to yep. the executive director at CPA. Go on.
I'm happy to take at least a start. The Department of Training and Workforce Development has just completed its strategic plan, and it started with a heavy stakeholder engagement. And the clear message was that, yeah, we need to promote the occupations within the vet sector, and the department needs to step up as part of that that promotional process, the value proposition of a vet qualification. I think there is a lot of work to do in that space, but as we can see, the future of work is evolving. I'm minded of one particular lady who did a commerce degree, so in essence an accounting degree, who wasn't really all that happy with the work, and she then went and did some time at Telethon Child or the Children's Institute, and she discovered that she really likes health, and she really wishes that she'd actually taken a degree course in that space. She ended up doing an anaesthetic technician course at VET, a diploma course, and quite highly rated in terms of its AQF standing. She's now loving the work of the anaesthetic technician, obviously works in operating theatres, etc. She's now also the National Trainee of the Year, and going enormously ahead in terms of her career, which is nothing like she expected. So I think there are many stories to tell about the range of occupations and for people to keep searching. And it takes us back to this concept of potentially trying jobs and doing traineeships or cadetships or whatever they are, seeing whether you fit in, and then being able to adjust early rather than making that 3 or 4 year commitment.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, and let me just try to come at this from a different perspective, because the question, sort of has a bit of a petitio principii, if I can use a technical term there. It begs the question, and it begs the question that the future is going to be set up in the same way. So you talk about the health sector. So in answering that, there's an automatic assumption about the way the health sector operates with certain jobs and certain job roles that exist within the way the current health is provided. If you start to think about what the future might look like, and you think about health as been involving a supply chain from illness or sickness or requirement through to delivery of service, that supply chain is going to be completely disrupted and changed by artificial intelligence. So the institutions that currently service our health sector will actually diminish in relevance. So for example, you look at 3D printing. It's already the case, and pharmacy companies are dealing with this, that you can online have a code sent to your 3D printer that says you're ready to have your next bout of a prescription medicine, which then goes into the 3D printer and prints your tablet that you need. You'll be monitored as to whether you've actually got the blood sugar levels or you've got the cholesterol levels that require that level of medication. It's done. So if you look at that in terms of the current supply chain, you don't need to go to your GP. Your GP doesn't have to give you a consultation to send you off to a specialist to then take some tests, to then take you somewhere else and give you a script to go to a pharmacy to get your drug. So the whole aspect of, and I talk about supply chain all the time, the whole aspect of supply chain that makes these industries like the health sector or the accounting profession currently exist, those will all be disrupted. So when you start to say, well, who are the health sector workers then? Well, they're the sorts of people that Nate's talking about. They're the sorts of people who come in with all sorts of agile skills, design thinking skills, that work out how do I take all this technology and deliver service in a way that actually unbounds all of these existing industrial society structures around the way we've delivered service. And that's the hardest thing for us to get our heads around in the way the future will look, because nothing will be the same. And you will be able to gain access to health services from a multitude of places via the internet and via other service providers, the traditional way of going to a doctor, then going to a hospital and so on. It will fundamentally change.
Another question. Hand over here.
This is for anyone, really. About 98% of our businesses are small business. So, you know, they're the ones that provide us with all our restaurants and shops and all sorts of things. And a lot of them aren't part of this learning environment. So how do we encourage more small businesses to think about progressing for the future?
I'm happy to take this one.
Yeah, cool.
So we do a lot of work, I didn't talk about it much, we do a lot of work with small business owners and entrepreneurs, getting them to think about what are those skill sets, or what are those skill gaps that they currently have with their businesses. We see a couple of common themes. One of those common themes is the idea of connectedness and collaboration, the ability to be able to form business communities that can learn off one another. So whether that be an incubator program, an accelerator program, the ability to be able to put 20 or 30 business owners into a room to calibrate, to get a sense of where they're at in terms of their business growth or their personal growth, and to not just learn from experts, which we do as well, but to learn from one another. And we're finding that traditional, which is just a blended learning approach, works really, really well, where we sit down with business owners for a couple of hours every week, we give them tasks and assignments to grow, and then they're working in small groups, small peer groups, where they're collaborating, learning, and connecting with one another. So it's a really tricky piece for small business owners. As a small business owner myself, I don't have enough time or money or budget for professional development. But the bottom line is it can't be non-negotiable. And so as industry, we need to find ways to reduce the barriers. And as government and state programs, things like SBDC, they do a great job of providing really low-cost programs in emerging skills, things like digital marketing, growth marketing, business management, those sort of things. So it's tricky, but I agree with you, it's probably just as important, if not more, to support those people rather than the people in the organisational roles.
And?
Yeah. If I might also add that, yeah, I think small business are the key and often very nimble. And a really good example of how we're connecting with small business is at MUREsc, the agricultural college. So there are a number of major courses and also a partnership with Curtin to do an associate degree course there. But in amongst that is a recognition that if you're in the agricultural industry and you're farming, you don't have 6 months to come and do a course. You need really short, sharp courses, just a few days, but you also need to understand about the latest technologies that are changing the face of agriculture. So we have partnerships with a host of providers who specialise in automation and, of course, high-tech detection and monitoring around the farm. And so this makes it achievable for small business. It's short, it's cheap, but it hits the spot.
Yeah.
And so, again, the challenge, I think, for us is to make sure that we have training in tiny courses that hit the spot. But can I say the other element, and I've been dying to mention this, and it is a bridge for all of the conversations that we've had today, is that it was really heartening for me to learn just a month ago that the Commonwealth have made a decision to extend what is called the unique student identifier into higher ed. So currently, if I'm a student at VET, I've got a number, and whatever I might study over my life, it records and measures what I've attained in a trusted repository. What has been now decided is we should apply that same unique identifier into the higher ed space. And what that in essence means is we will be able to switch and swap around and do a unit here and a unit of competency there, and we will have a trusted record of our lifelong journey of education. So if you like, our skills passport. And so for me, it's a really important piece in this navigation of how we manage this new space that we're in.
Thank you, Anne.
Very quickly.
30 seconds. 30. Go on.
I mean, one prognosis is that small business is the future. One prognosis is you'll have 8 billion adults with 8 billion individual industries of one person. Because what technology has done, and you've all experienced this, is I can now set up my own little niche business to serve something. I can have my smartphone with a thing called Square attached to it, where you can put your credit card against it and make a payment. I can then get onto my supplier that has the inventory that supplies me directly to service the needs of my people. I don't need a retail store, I don't need a shop, I don't need to have a warehouse. So actually you're seeing the growth in some respects of those small businesses, and technology is enabling us all to create little niche opportunities for us to create income for ourselves around tiny little aspects of serving other people with their requirements, which is different from our traditional high street infrastructures. Retail is being completely disrupted by that. So small industry and small business is actually the future.
Okay, thank you. So look, I've got strict instructions to land this at 5 to 2, so I'm just following instructions from the back. Can I just first of all thank the panel for their time and their thoughts? The next thing I've got to do is very quickly is to introduce the person who's going to give the vote of thanks, which is Jane Thompson. And my notes tell me that she's a partner at McKinsey & Company, and that Jane joined McKinsey's in 2006 in the Operational Excellence Academy, the Knowledge Development Centre of that organisation. Jane.